In this era of grave spiritual crisis, it is not enough to simply know about your Catholic faith. That is why we need a Catholic toolbox to equip us with the practical skills necessary to live our Catholic faith to reach our ultimate goal, which is heaven for all eternity. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for the Catholic Toolbox as we hand you the tools to go forth, live the faith, and change our modern world today. Live on the Voice of Charity. And welcome back to another week on the Catholic Toolbox, the Art of Practical Catholicism. I'm your host and founder, George Manasseh, here on 1701 AM, the Voice of Charity Radio Network, and live also on Cradio Online Radio, as we equip you with practical solutions to live your Catholic faith in our modern world today. And tonight we're speaking about a very interesting and very also controversial topic, which is the subject of the Catholic education system. And of course, we are here to make the Catholic education system great again, or Catholic again, or the title is a little bit American tonight, but we have our good, a good friend of the Voice of Charity, Robert Haddad. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much, George. Happy to be on. Thank you.
Thank you for being with me tonight. Now, look, tonight's topic is obviously dear to a lot of people, a lot of parents, who've looked over the past, let's say, 40 to 50 years and seen a gradual decline in the quality of how our kids are being educated. Now, tonight we're not putting fingers at anybody. We're just looking at the general overall Catholic education system. So obviously, Robert, you are a Catholic apologist and author, and you also work for the Archdiocese of Sydney. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, Sydney Catholic Schools Office, which looks after 152 Catholic primary and secondary schools in the Archdiocese of Sydney.
Exactly, and we very much appreciate your presence here tonight. And look, where do we start? Where do we start by looking at what is Catholic education? Let's set some parameters here tonight, because I mean, what we may define as Catholic education may be, let's say, a little bit inadequate for some families or too adequate for others. Let's set some parameters here tonight. What should a good Catholic education in light of church tradition and good history look like, especially adapted to our modern world today?
Well, I'll start off by saying something you probably won't expect me to say. Good Catholic education begins and ends with the parents. They're the ones who are to be models of faith, hope, and charity. They're the ones to be models of virtue, of prayer. And they're the ones who need to be, first of all, and most primarily responsible for imparting the faith to their children. Catholic schools or Catholic school systems only exist in theory and in practice to support the parents in that endeavor. So this is the first point we need to emphasize. And I noticed that the title of your show is about toolbox and practical solutions to living out our Catholic faith, etc. No matter what we might think of Catholic schools, the system, independent schools, par-ed schools, homeschooling, whatever model we might look at.
Homeschooling, wow.
Yeah, the essential, most important point here about Catholic education is that it comes from the parents, and the parents can never abrogate or pass on that obligation to someone else. And if we remember that, you know, particularly young people contemplating relationships, contemplating marriage and contemplating a family, they must understand that they're the first educators, they're the most important educators, and whatever choices they make by way of assisting them to pass on the faith, that's what it is. What am I going to call upon to assist me, my husband, my wife, to do fulfill that obligation with respect to my children?
Exactly. So basically, the Catholic education system, we're not naming any names. We're not pointing to anything tonight. I think everybody can make their own judgments. So when we point to the system itself, it's there to complement the education of the parents who are the primary educators.
Well, that's correct.
That's what you're saying.
In today's modern world, and we realized this a very long time ago, we're on the verge of celebrating 200 years of Catholic schools in Australia. So we realized a very long time ago, in the first decades of the 19th century, that parents can't pass on everything that's necessary to their children to enable their children to live viable lives in society. So in addition to passing on the faith, schools are also called upon to pass on other knowledge, other sciences, other technical skills, etc. So, for example, you know, you might have parents who don't know much about mathematics. Well, who's going to pass on that knowledge? You know, you need external teachers, or science, particularly the higher sciences, the physics, the chemistries. Who's going to teach history in depth? Who's going to teach about economics or you know, legal studies, all these other subjects that we provide in the HSC. So Catholic schools exist also for that purpose, to assist parents to pass on these knowledge of these other practical, everyday, worldly sciences to their children. But first and foremost, Catholic schools exist to pass on the faith, or to assist the parents in passing on the faith. So Catholic schools, if they're very good at teaching maths or science or English or history or geography or whatever discipline, that's all good. But public schools can do that. So what differentiates Catholic schools from the public school system? Public schools are also for free. So why am I paying extra? And what am I getting extra from Catholic schools for the fees?
Yeah, what are we getting extra, Robert? That's an interesting question. So what are we getting extra? I mean, you've hit the pivotal point tonight in our modern world today of 2020. We're looking at the Catholic education system, not anything in particular. We're just speaking principle in concept about Catholic education. And each person listening here tonight can apply it to their situation wherever it may be. It's up to their discretion to do so. And that's a disclaimer we make tonight. But now let's go into what really happened to Catholic education. I mean, we have 8% of Catholics who go to mass today, 8 to 12%, depending on where you are. And I hope I'm wrong. I'm not trying to substantiate with any evidence, because I hope I'm incorrect. I hope somebody has some statistics that's increased.
I don't think you are incorrect. Our statistics are telling us, both ABS census statistics and the church life surveys, the Catholic practice on average is down to about 10%. Maronites in the survey I read are around 49%. Now that looks great. You know, 49% is where the Roman Church was, I think, in the early 70s. And I don't want to. I'm rejoiced at the fact that we're 49% as against 10%. But the last time I knew percentages, 49% failure. So, but I mean, at our best in the history of the church in Australia, say in the post-World War II period, practicing rates were approximately around 55%, somewhere between 60% in the so-called good old days. I mean, how we would love to go back to that, but ultimately, really, we should be idealistically 100% if we want to save everybody.
Exactly. And you know what's actually shocking is that there was a research that about 60 to 70% of those Catholics in the pews don't even believe in the real presence of our Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, fundamental dogmas of the faith are still not believed. A lot of contracepting. Well, and I hope we're wrong. I mean, somebody bring out a good statistic.
You know, we love to be people of hope, and we love to be people who are optimistic, but we got to be realistic. And what I'm about to say is based on hardcore data. I was privy to a survey presentation back in 2014 by a Dr. Robert Dixon, and I can name him because he's on the public record and he's produced academic papers with respect to what I'm about to say. But he used to work as a chief statistician for the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference, and listening to a presentation he gave to staff at Sydney Catholic Schools somewhere in the second half of 2014, it was very obvious that only 2% of Catholics 2% of Catholics in this country both go to regular Mass, and regular Mass is defined as once a month, by the way. Mass, believe all the teachings of the church. So we say we've got about a regular Mass attendance of 10%, and that's not even weekly Mass. And only 2%, 2 out of 100% of Catholics in this country actually accept all church teachings, whether it be on the real presence, the dogmas of Our Lady, or what reserving the ministerial priesthood to men alone, or whatever that might be.
Yeah, so genuine, authentically practicing Catholic. We're not here to point fingers and say you're not a practicing Catholic or not, but obviously to be a good Catholic in line with church teaching, you must accept all dogmas. And that's actually very interesting, because that goes now into what we're going to talk about, the three pillars of formation, which is the family, as we spoke about first, the home, the parish, and the school. Now, let's look at all three. The first one, we've gone 40 to 50 years without forming sufficiently Catholics who then became parents and now are supposed to be imparting the faith to their children. And now another set of generation, every year we have Catholic school kids and any area of Catholic education leaving and not practicing the faith. I mean, so we can't really rely. This is why I say the three-legged stool of the family, the parish, and the school. We can't rely on the family anymore, at least to a large extent, because we can't walk into their homes and tell them to come back to church. They've already left the faith, and that's what they're going to be imparting onto their kids as the primary educators. The second is the parish. We can only deal with whoever comes to Mass on Sunday, which is 8 to 10% of Catholics. The third leg that we actually have a significant amount of influence to change the course of the numbers of Mass attendance and practicing Catholics and revive the faith. And we can do that if we, and I mean, the Catholic education system is very influential worldwide. I mean, in every single country, we own a great vast amount of the education system in this country. I mean, what kind of number do you have? How much of the schools, let's say in this country, are actually Catholic schools?
Look, I should know that number off the top of my head, but I don't, unfortunately. But I can just in general about the situation in New South Wales. We've got about 50% of our students, Catholic students, in Catholic schools, and roughly another 50% in the public school system. It's a bit better in the Sydney Archdiocese, but in Sydney Catholic Schools Office schools, we've got over 70,000 students. That doesn't include Catholics in independent congregational schools, some of those really well-known ones like Ignatius Riverview and St. Joseph's at Hunters Hill, Santa Sabina, Strathfield, et cetera. Most families are not sending their children to mainstream parochial Catholic schools. Because slightly more than half are going to, when you tally it up, public schools, congregational independent schools, or maybe a bit of homeschooling here on the side. That is of concern, of course, particularly those students who are being sent to public schools. Whether they're receiving any faith content or not depends on whether they're a catechist. But if I could just backtrack a little bit, George, about those three mentioned. I think we're now into our third generation of Catholics who have not been catechized properly. And that is the problem we are now facing is that, and this might sound harsh, excuse me for the language, but ignorance begetting ignorance. And now we're just catechizing one generation to another, passing on the faith to less and less people. That is a frightening aspect we must confront, we must be aware of. Parishes, well, parishes, I believe, should be centres of evangelisation. And priests, who are far and few between, are very stressed already. But there should be parish teams employing lay people from the parish to be more evangelistic and more outgoing and more door-knocking and more invitational. We got this function across the board. But we're in a situation, I liken the situation we're in to a type of guerrilla war, like urban guerrilla war. There's rubble everywhere. The war looks lost, but we can still fight and we can still win many small victories, individual victories. And we should be in this metaphoric rubble, looking for individuals to convert them, to bring them to faith, to bring them to prayer, to bring them to sacraments, to bring them to God through Jesus Christ, etc. That is still eminently viable, and we should be endeavoring in everything we do to win individuals back to God, back to the church, through our own personal apostle.
Robert, that's absolutely phenomenal what you said there. I mean, we have the three-legged stool. I mean, we don't have any more say in, we can't walk into people's homes and we tell them, come back to church, none of our business. We can't really have too much leg there. We can't have too much leg, let's say, to bring back mass numbers through the parishes. It's only whoever goes to mass on Sunday. And again, they're understaffed. Parish priests are understaffed. It's the role of the laity. But now the education system, the Catholic education system, what went wrong, Robert? What went wrong? We can do so much just by, if people are evangelized through the education system, the mass numbers that we have, if we had, let's say, the evangelical effect that we're talking about, where we're bringing good speakers, we're handing out solid material. Let's say, I'll give you an example from Parousia Media. We're handing out and we're bringing the sacraments to them. Hypothetically, let's come up with a practical plan on every educational area level. Can't we bring back the numbers? We can.
George, let me answer your question. What went wrong?
Okay. What went wrong to start with?
People who I know who are old enough, they remember the so-called good old days, okay? And generally, there are people educated in the 40s and 50s through to the mid-60s, and they remember the time when they were educated by Sister Scholastica or Brother Alphonsus or whatever. So religious predominated in our schools. And the teaching was rigorous. The teaching was catechetical method by way of rote learning, answers to questions, etc. People were drilled in the knowledge of their faith. Okay. From the mid-60s onwards, we had a transition. We had less people going into religious life, joining these teaching religious orders, etc. And we transitioned as a system from religious, priests and religious, to lay teachers. In Sydney Catholic Schools office now, we only got one religious who's a principal in our 152 schools. He's a very good principal. He's an excellent principal. He's a role model of a religious and a principal, but only one left. When we transitioned, and this became predominant in the 70s and et cetera onwards, this is where I think the breakdown took place. A religion was, we did not transition to form these lay teachers well. They were not grounded strongly in doctrine, in theology, in philosophy, in scripture. And we moved also away from the catechetical method to what we call the life relevance method. So religion lessons were no longer primarily imparting doctrine, but about life experience. And for many people, religion became the joke. I call it the beanbag era, where beanbag theology, we're just bringing the beanbag, sit on the floor, sing kumbaya, relate personal life experiences. Now, teaching the faith should be relevant to life experience. There's no doubt about it. We've got to have that balance. We're still imparting. We're still engaging in instruction and still getting people to learn their faith with a level of seriousness and urgency, knowing that this is important for my eternal salvation. This is about not about just learning practical skills to live in the real world, but to learn about spiritual skills to be faithful in the real world, traveling towards heaven. And we watered down the doctrine. We stopped talking about sin. We stopped mentioning the devil. We don't talk about hell. We forgot about purgatory. We downplayed prayer and penance and abstinence and fasting. And all this collectively became a tsunami that made religion the subject that you can put last period on Fridays, or the subject you can always take when you have to have a year meeting, or the subject that becomes the blood subject. And that is simplistic, but essentially what happened in so many places in Catholic education from the 70s onwards.
Who do we blame?
It's hard to say, and I don't know whether we should be so focused on to pinpoint who is to blame. What is essential is that we must recognise, and we have recognised, and we in Sydney Archdiocese, we certainly recognise that many years ago, and at the level of the New South Wales Bishops' Conference, when we know we have a document called Catholic Schools at the Crossroads, came out in 2007, which identified issues and also charted a way forward, an excellent way forward. And if we implemented what the New South Wales Bishops said in that statement, we'll be well on the path to recovery. But firstly, let's recognise there is a problem. We have to identify what the problem is. And essentially, it's about teachers, their witness, their personal life, their knowledge, their passion, their enthusiasm in the classroom, whether they're taken seriously. If we get the teacher right, we can get the teaching of the faith right. In Sydney Archdiocese, in our schools, we've worked very hard, tirelessly in the last decade and a half on improving our curriculum, on improving our textbooks, on improving RE examination, on improving RE pedagogy, that is the way we teach, et cetera, on introducing evangelization, youth ministry, family educators, staff faith formation. We've done a lot there. This is all good. This is all part of the package. But in the core, in the capillaries, there in the trenches, what is most important, do we have the teacher as a faithful witness that can not only teach the faith, but by way of example, inspire young people to live it?
Exactly.
Students will pick up the faith more from a person, a witness, than from a textbook or from a curriculum or from an exam.
Exactly. I mean, that's absolutely well said, because I mean, they're great ideas. I mean, to reform the curriculum, to come up with nice ideas, strategize, but then when we hand it to the people implementing it, I mean, it's there. That is where the real effect takes place. And I can attest to that personally. The reason why I came back to that was because of the personal encouragement, not because of the curriculum or the system itself, but the personal encouragement out of their own personal time and energy of several good Catholic teachers who directed me. And it was not through the system itself. It was actually because of their own sideline assistance to me and answering my theological questions and directing me where I can learn my faith in detail. That's how I came back to the faith. I mean, it's amusing.
I'll give you one example that was given to me about 2 months ago. Okay. Names of the person or the school involved.
No names, no school.
It's a secondary school in our system. And there's this young teacher, Lebanese Maronite background, who started his first
year. Who was the Lebanese Maronites?
Maronite person background, but born in Australia, raised and educated in Australia, and started teaching RE in one of our secondary schools. And he's given me updates on how it's going, and now he's been offered a full-time contract after just one term. And he said, you know, look, he rang me once, he said, Robert, you know, I'm teaching year 8 and year 9 kids, and they told me that their teacher they had last year, all that teacher would do is come into the classroom, set the work, get the kids to be silent to work on their work, and then sit down and do and say nothing. And now the students are amazed that they've got a young teacher still in his 20s in front of them who's not only just setting the work, but talking to them passionately and answering their questions and helping them in their faith growth. And there's an explosion of enthusiasm for the faith in those young students. Why? The teacher made the difference, not just coming in and sitting down, being a professional Catholic only, setting out the work, and not saying anything, but being in there as a passionate professional Catholic and actually living it out in front of them and bringing those kids alive in the faith. That's the difference. That's where the solution is to be found, in identifying, encouraging, nurturing, mentoring these young teachers to be faithful in the classroom and to aspire to leadership one day so they can be role models in front of other staff and in front of the whole school community.
Exactly. That's absolutely true. And that definitely fits my experience and the experience of so many. I've spoken to about 50 to 60 people first-handedly who've gone through the Catholic education system, and they've gone through all levels, and they've come back to the faith through outside the system, sort because and teachers who've actually gone through the effort outside the textbook to really explain to them and show them by example. I mean, that's, I mean, we can set all the curriculum you want. I mean, your experience in the Archdiocese of Sydney is that we can set curriculums, we can set nice ideas, but if it's not actually done when people hit the classroom, there's no experience there. So, I mean, the importance of auditing whether or not somebody's an actually a practicing Catholic. And you mentioned something very interesting, which is about professional Catholics. That's something which often gets thrown around now as pretty much a problem. I mean, what do you think that there are many people who professionally market themselves as Catholic educators at any level, and they don't have the best interest of the faith in mind on all levels?
Well, look, I think a big problem in the Church Universal is that we can easily call ourselves Catholic, but in there are many nominal Catholics. They're Catholic by name, but are they Catholic by way of the profession of their faith or living out their faith? Now, when I say professional Catholic, I'm talking about people, yes, they're baptized Catholics. They call themselves Catholic. They work in a Catholic institution. They get well paid in that institution. But are their hearts on fire for the faith? Do they love God? Do they love Jesus Christ? Do they model their lives on Jesus Christ? Do they want to impart the fullness of the Catholic faith? Or are they? Do they suffer from a certain level of cynicism, criticism, negativity, undermining the faith, underliving the faith? And
setting, good salary?
Sorry?
Good salary?
Oh, they still collect a good salary. But the reality is we got to move from that radically and as soon as possible, move away from that model to the model of the Catholic who's passionate and professional. Not just passionate and not just professional, but both. Because it's a professional environment and there are high stakes involved in teaching subjects for the HSC and parental expectations. But model the faith with love. That's it. That's what we need.
Exactly. And look, as a manager myself, obviously I look to audit things all the time. And look, I like to look at things from a business standpoint. And look, so you have the curriculum, you have the planning, the whole planning stage. But should auditing the actual teachers themselves or the educators at any level be part? Is that part currently part of the process involved?
Yeah, well, we certainly do review senior leadership in schools. The principals, APs, RECs, and also our youth ministry coordinators and our family educators are all reviewed. They're on contracts and they have a review every 2 years or every 4 years, etc. There's no doubt about it. Now, when it comes to their actual professional qualifications to teach, we have a accreditation process or program in our system. Now, 93% of our teachers who teach RE, we've got about 3,500 teachers in our 152 schools who teach religious education, who teach the Catholic faith. 93% of them are now formally qualified at the levels that we expect them to. And we invest enormous amounts of money in getting teachers to be formally qualified.
What's the proper qualification process?
Well, for example, okay, just to teach RE, just to be a teacher of religious education, they need 6 units undergrad in theology or religious education.
Actual theology units.
Yeah, yes, at undergrad
level. Not generalist religious studies.
No, that's right, Catholic faith. If they don't have that, they need 4 units postgrad graduate certificate in RE or diploma. If they want to aspire to religious leadership, that is an REC, they need a formal master's degree in theology or religious education, etc. And that we have that across the board. Now, that's good. It's 93%,
I mean, it's a great idea. Yeah.
93% is the highest we've ever had. And we're moving towards, and we audit that. We have staff who are employed just to audit.
They Catholic and practicing Catholics themselves, verified.
But again, that's good. That's necessary, but it's not enough. It's not enough to have that degree and have it on a wall and call yourself a master in religious education or theology. We know what is important. I'd rather have a teacher in the classroom who's faithful in practice, passionate, enthusiastic, and a good model than someone who's got a degree on the wall who comes into the classroom and is dead boring or unenthusiastic or undermines or poisons the faith of students. I'd rather have unqualified. But ultimately, what's ideal is to have the person who's qualified and passionate at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, that's the ideal world that we're in. And look, it seems to me that it's easy to create a curriculum. It's easy to create these ideas and these processes in place, but then it's hard to really track, let's say, all right, maybe the heads of religious departments and systems, but then on the ground level, a simple teacher in a simple school or any other institution teaching the faith, they've gone through university, they've gotten their piece of paper that they can teach a religion. Are you concerned about those individual people who make up? Are you concerned at their Catholicity?
Yeah, I'm concerned. I have a lot to do with young teachers in particular, because in my responsibility as head of new evangelization, and I have a responsibility for staff faith formation, and we have beginning teacher retreats. So I meet many, you know, hundreds of new teachers every year in our system. And I can say this with a lot of confidence. In a system which has about 9,500 employees, and I don't know everybody, but I might see or speak to 2,000 to 2,500 staff a year. I know of hundreds of people in our system, personally, at all levels, from principal downwards, for first year beginning teachers through to principal, who are good Catholics, who are good role models, who are passionate, enthusiastic, and care about the students and want to develop them and grow them in their faith, in their prayer life, in their enthusiasm, etc. And I have a group, an email group called the Barnabas Group, and I've got over 100 young teachers in this email group that I send information to about this event or this speaker or this talk or this conference, etc. And I call it Barnabas Group because Barnabas means father of consolation, okay? Or sorry, father of encouragement, to be more correct, okay? And I want to encourage these young teachers, and I always have concern about young teachers who are finding teaching difficult. I grieve when young teachers who are good leave teaching altogether. That has happened. I rejoice.
Focus a little bit on that. Let's say I've met a lot of good Catholic teachers who've studied and they're living the way they give their life for the faith. And then they go to, let's say, a school or another institution, and then they experience a lot of backlash from the managerial authority. That's the concern to me. And then their job is at risk.
Yeah. Look, I think that's still a problem in certain situations. It's not a problem in other situations. I think if prudence is always called for and a level of professionalism as well. I'm not saying that those who suffer difficulties are unprofessional. Far from that. There are genuine difficulties, and I have seen teachers and know of teachers who have left teaching because of those difficulties. I do know, though, of many others who, despite these difficulties, or they work in situations where they don't have difficulties, who are actually successful as religious educators, and they're slowly climbing the ranks. There are many, many very good religious education coordinators now who are young people rising up the ranks who are going to be excellent in their job. They're going to lead students to goodness, truth, and beauty, and they're going to go further in their careers as APs and principals one day or even higher. And I'm not going to be around to see that necessarily, because at my age, I've only got about 10 to 15 years left, whatever God gives me. But that, you know, I have to help encourage the next generation of teachers and leaders to continue and expand whatever work our team is doing now. The good work we're doing now is done by a couple of dozen people. And we need to secure the future of that. We need to breed and nurture, mentor successors to ourselves and future principals of schools. And we get the principals right, the whole school will turn.
Exactly. And look, that's very well said there, Robert. I just want to remind our listeners here tonight, we won't be taking any questions due to the controversy of this topic. Obviously, I definitely believe I'm representing everybody's concerned. There are very few, but very strong questions that everybody would want to ask. And I believe I'm representing everybody's major concerns, at least that I've spoken to first-handedly, and also the fact that these are general concerns. I mean, but I want to continue to focus on, you've spoken about what's being done. As a manager, from a business standpoint, I like to look at things in a five-year plan. And my thoughts are that in the next 5 years, we're going to have the rapid rise of secularism. We have no more say politically as a church. We're graduating students every year from any education system that's Catholic. And the numbers are declining further and further. Can we rely just only solely on reforming the mainstream system? Should we not be forming alternative, let's say, education paths for our kids? For instance, I'll give you an example. Many traditional Catholics and Orthodox Catholics are reverting to homeschooling. Some are reverting, obviously, to the Pared schools. We won't name names. And some are reverting to other, let's say, Eastern Catholic schools because they know there's a bit better Catholic quality assurances there. But should we be, let's say, working in the next 5 years to sort of improve the mainstream system, but as well form side education alternatives off the grid of the mainstream system?
I support all that. I support, most importantly, the rights of parents to decide for themselves who they will employ to assist them to be the first teachers of the faith for their children. That is an inalienable right. I will never tell any parent how or where to send their kids to learn the faith. Now, if parents want homeschooling, God bless them, all power, all strength to them. Go for it. If they want to consider par-ed models or Eastern Catholic school models because they know there's a stronger emphasis on family values, traditional religious values, and a higher percentage of fervent teachers of the faith in those schools, God bless them, go for it. At the same time, I work in a system of schools and I have a responsibility given to me, ultimately from God, to do my best for those schools and to work in those schools for the improvement of those schools. I don't believe in this thought, this idea that was once given to me, let it all collapse. Now, I'm not here about letting it all collapse.
I've heard it many times. We just let the system collapse and then
let the system collapse. Now, let's be a bit radical here. Let the system collapse and give the whole thing over to the enemy and surrender. That's called white flag strategy.
Exactly.
As I said earlier, things are not great. And I said it's like fighting an urban guerrilla war. Well, let's keep fighting it and let's win what we can win and improve what we can improve and rebuild what we can rebuild and make great Catholic education, wherever it may be, in the mainstream system, in the congregational school, in the par ed schools, in the Eastern Catholic schools, and in homeschooling, all the better. I'm about converting people to authentic faith, hope, and love, and relationship with God and Jesus Christ. And whatever means we use to achieve that, so be it.
And believe me, everybody agrees. Look, Robert, that's just some very phenomenal stuff that you've given us, some very serious insight. And look, I look at it this way, from a strategically a warfare perspective, we need to be fighting from every angle. We need archers, we need horsemen, we need footmen. Of course, we need to work from the system. We need to work from, let's say, independent bodies. We need to be working from every avenue. This is a war that we have to fight. But what is going to be done in the next 5 years? Can, let's say, the bishops, and let's now talk about the bishop, what's the role, what can the bishop do in all of this?
The bishop can do a lot, and the bishop is very powerful, and the bishop is the first and foremost teacher of the faith in his diocese. And so that says it all. And that's always been the case in the history of the church. The bishop is the first teacher of the faithful in the diocese. The priests, the deacons, the lay people, whoever they are, the professional lay people, all participate in the bishop's mission to impart the faith, to evangelize, to teach, to catechize, etc., etc. So the bishop has enormous power and responsibility. And I will only speak on behalf of what I know in the Archdiocese of Sydney. It was Cardinal Pell many years ago who took a decisive step to reform, firstly in Melbourne when he was Archbishop there, Catholic textbooks, Catholic curriculum, and then he brought the same momentum with the Sydney Archdiocese. And as a Cardinal, he made the important step to employ my boss, Anthony Cleary, as head of, and he created a new directorate in religious education and evangelization, which didn't exist independently before, and appointed my boss as head of that. An enormous change has happened because of that decisive move. And Archbishop Anthony, who succeeded Cardinal Pell, has continued in the same vein with the same rigor and vigor and passion and enthusiasm. I mean, Archbishop Anthony is a Dominican, and they're teachers and preachers, and he is so concerned, absolutely passionate, personally, intimately concerned about Catholic education. He's appointed a new executive director of schools last year. He's reemployed my boss in his role, and he knows and he wants to know very intimately what we're doing by way of imparting the faith, by way of evangelization, by way of youth ministry, World Youth Day participation, Australian Catholic Youth Festival participation, you name it. How we're working with the Archdiocese, how we're connecting young people with parishes. He is full on, and I can't fault that at all. And it's he keeps us on our toes, and he keeps us knowing that we are accountable for what we're doing with the commission we have.
Exactly. Look, from a young person's perspective like myself, I've seen that events, World Youth Day, Australian Catholic Youth Festival, they've been much more effective in the system itself. I mean, just these events alone can have turned people back from their former ways into following Christ. And look, again, that stuff on a managerial level is very good. But
I say, to build on what you just said there, I call those events, those extraordinary events, bypass surgery. Sometimes in their local context in the school, there's a blockage. And we bypass that blockage through these, you know, Ignite festivals or these Australian Catholic Youth Festivals or these World Youth Day events. Now, going back, you know, 15, 25 years ago, I was very cynical and critical of World Youth Days. And I was too. Yeah, you know, as Catholic Woodstocks, and look at the negative things about them, etc. But I began to change when I was in university chaplaincy in 2002, and I met adults who'd been to World Youth Days who kept telling me that their conversion experience happened at World Youth Day in Paris, or World Youth Day in Rome, or World Youth Day in Manila in the Philippines, or whatever. And I began to think, well, something good coming out of this. And now, having worked sending students and staff to World Youth Days, Krakow in 2016, Panama in 2019, I see the impact. The World Youth Day is not just about that meeting with the Pope there. It's at that particular city. It's about the formation program beforehand and the catechesis we give during the weeks we're overseas and the post-World Youth Day catechesis afterwards.
Exactly. Look, and they've been very effective. I mean, some of these events have probably done more than, let's say, 13 years of so-called education. I mean, look, I'm going to ask you a very tough question now. I will give you power over the entire Catholic education system at all levels, full autonomy and full discretion. What would your master plan look like for the next 5 years? I'm concerned about the next 5 years because they're going to be crucial. We need to be very active. We need to think like a business, basically. I mean, we are in survival mode, and we need to bring, and obviously it's God's work. It's not our work. And we need to be instruments of his grace, but I'll give you full power. And what would your master plan look like?
It'll start with me taking personal responsibility for the appointment of all principals. Because I believe that it's about recapitation, reheading. Most people who work in any environment, and I don't mean to say this as an insult, most people are sheep. They follow the leader. They do what the leader says, what the leader wants in order to keep their job, blah, blah, blah. Okay? If I would take personal responsibility to ensure that the best person from the faith perspective is appointed as principals in all schools, going from kindergarten straight to year 12, and to ensure that that principal prioritizes is the leader of faith formation and witness in their school, because that will flow down to the rest of the staff. And that will give security to all the faithful teachers. And that will flow into the classroom. And parents will feel that and know that. Things will change. That would be the one priority, chief priority among many. I mean, you ask me a big question and there's a lot we can do in 5 years. The other thing I would say, and I'll say it with a little bit of humour, I'll just fund the our mission and identity directorate, as it's called now, to give it whatever it needs and to unleash the director, my current boss, to do whatever he wants and for his teams to do whatever they want. And of course, at the same time, juggling all the other responsibilities, you know, to ensure that Catholic schools are the best when it comes to delivering the HSC results, the ATARs that parents want. Because if we're not doing the job there, they'll go elsewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about holistic formation. I mean, and so you would then obviously appoint good Catholic principals. And then how would you continue, let's say, and obviously you'd continue with what we spoke about before, which is implementing the curriculum by which they can learn the faith and get the proper theological formation. How would you then audit that these teachers are genuinely in love with our Lord and want to spread the faith? Well, that's the hard part.
The auditing has to be first. When it comes to teachers in the classroom, the chief responsibility there lies with the principal and the REC to determine who are the best teachers to teach RE in the classroom. You can't expect head office to be concerned about what's happening directly in the classroom.
Exactly.
Right. Head office appoints the school leadership team, and the school leadership team should run the schools. And they should know who should be teaching RE. And I wouldn't give RE to anybody who doesn't want it. You only give teaching religion to those teachers who want it, who beg for it, who line up for it, and who are passionate and believers and witnesses. And you don't give it to with all respect to art teachers or maths teachers, you don't give it to the art or maths.
Non-Catholic teachers. I mean, we had some questionable teachers.
Yeah, and you don't give it to those people who, just to fill their timetable last period on a Friday, and those people have no enthusiasm for the class, and that infects the students, right? So that's what I would do. And it's not that hard. Well, sometimes it is, but it's not that hard to find enough teachers who want to teach RE. And if they want to teach it, they're the ones you give it to first, and they're the ones you give the senior students to, and they're the ones you give the year 7 and 8 students to, because you've got to have those year 7 and 8 students starting well in high school when it comes to the faith. And I'll tell you why, because we know from our stats, we've done a meta survey from 2014, 16, 18, 17,000 students on average each survey, the biggest ever survey of Catholic students done by any institution ever. And we know that children are falling off the cliff when it comes to their faith, knowledge and practice between year 7 and 9. And that's happening the same in the United States. Around the age of 13, kids are making big time decisions about whether to hang on to their faith or not. And most of them are not. And I know, and this is a stat I'm telling people publicly and privately, where our stats are telling us when kids come into year 7, 13% of them either don't believe in God or don't know whether God exists. So there's 13% who are atheists or agnostic. By the time they get to year 11, that's increased to 33% in our schools. So we are one third of the students by year 11 are agnostic or atheist. And the big question is why? And there are multiple reasons why. It's culture, it's society, it's the family, it's the parish, it's the school, it's the classroom. There are multiple factors why. But we need to concentrate on what's happening in years 7, 8, and 9, and we need to ground people in giving them adult answers to adult questions and not leave them with a simple primary school level faith. We need them of secularism and new atheism and all the hostility to the faith, and give them the answers that they are wanting to the questions they're hearing in society.
Exactly. That is spot on, Robert. That is absolutely true, because that mimics my experience and the experience of so many other young people. I mean, we went through the mainstream system. We never heard anything about questions, let's say abortion, homosexuality, euthanasia, contraception. There's a big one. I mean, we don't hear answers to that. And you know who's answering the questions? It's society. Society is the one that's answering the questions for them. And when faith isn't being shone and it's absent and the light is dimmed, no wonder they got off the rails. I mean, do we want any more answers? I mean, it's pretty simple. Dale,
did you ever...
Yep, sorry, you're back.
Yeah, I think that was my phone losing power. But okay. Have you ever heard, did you ever hear the word apologetics in your school days?
Absolutely not. It was not through the mainstream system. It was through a good teacher out of his own will who handed me a book, and it was through Parousia Media who brought, let's say, Tim Staples, and I had a CD there, and I went off on my own having to learn that. That's because I had the time and the enthusiasm and the energy. But what about the other kids who were off busy? They didn't have the time. They didn't have that person to be that light of Christ. We're leaving it up to chance. And then we complain, oh, where's the problem? It must be that we're not welcoming enough at the parish. It must be we're not pastoral enough. I mean, there's the problem.
But apologetics by itself is not the solution alone, but it's part of the solution, because we need to teach better what of our faith, but we need to also answer the why questions. Why? And there we are falling down to some extent, or to a large extent. We're not giving the deeper reasoned explanations for our faith and what we believe in. I mean, it goes back to 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give a reasoned explanation for the hope that is in us. And and for some reason, apologetics, it's a long word and we don't like it. It means religious argument. Let's get rid of that. That's not what it means anymore.
But we argue about other things, Robert. We can have time to argue about the footy, about, you know, meaningless things, but we don't have time for religion. I mean, it just seems to me a very fair and open-minded view. So look, let's now talk about, we talked about, okay, what you would do as your master plan had I given you the power and the full autonomy. And my master plan, hypothetically, and one I speak to many young people, and I have this conversation with many young people around Sydney, around New South Wales, around Australia and internationally. I mean, everybody agrees with me, believe me. We need to make Catholic education Catholic again. So, but let's now talk about the parish priest. The parish priest himself is the head of the school. Am I not right?
Canonically speaking, yes. If the school is within the parish boundaries of the priest, of the parish priest, then he has ultimate responsibility for the faith formation that occurs in the school. Now, we engage our priests in many different ways, and we always have them on selection panels for Principal AP and REC, and even for family educators. And so we as much as possible get them involved. And I can tell you now, I've witnessed it. If a priest doesn't want X, we don't employ X. If the priest is adamant we employ Y, we employ Y. And we respect that canonical authority that they have. And often most priests will work in hand with them, and there's a mutual, you know, partnership, and it's all friendly and we're on the same page. Okay. And priests are very busy. And we don't have the abundance of priests we used to do. And so we do have priests sometimes coming into the classroom, us being a presence in the staff room, being a presence in the playground. We've got seminarians, second year seminarians in primary schools. We've got six this year, but of course.
We put them to use,
The COVID put that to an end temporarily. We're having a developing chaplaincy program. We've got four young priests working part-time in four different schools. That's going to grow. I hope to have a chaplain, young priest, in every secondary school by the end of the next 10 years. I know it takes time, but rolling out a program takes time. And so, yes, what you're saying about the role of priest is very important.
Exactly. I mean, see, this attitude of taking time, it's going to take time. I had a good priest friend of mine say it's going to take 40 years to restore. Is the world... is the secular media, the secular culture working at this slow time that we're speaking about? Because they're working day and night. They are advancing. They are capitalizing. Should we not be working at that same pace, if not more, times three times their energy to make up for the, let's say, the lagging of the past, let's say, 40 to 50 years, and to make up for that, we should be working at a faster pace.
I wish we could. I agree with you. But the problem is, and I said this to someone quite a few years ago, you can't turn a gigantic ship around easily. You can't city that has been burned to the ground overnight. And to get new leaders, to have a new collection of RECs, APs and principals, takes 30 years. A young teacher who's just come out of ACU or Notre Dame or Sydney University goes into the classroom at the age of 22, is not ready for leadership for many years. Okay, so, you know, they have to be, you know, they might get a promotional position in their late 20s, but they, you know, they might be an REC in their early 30s, but they might be an AP in their 40s, and they might be a principal when they're 45. Now, that's 20 years already, you see? It takes time. That's the problem.
That makes a bit more sense. Yeah, definitely. Look, so we spoke about getting the parish priest involved. I mean, because he canonically has jurisdiction over the school. So definitely, if parish priests could start getting more involved, and let's now go into three practical solutions about what we can do on a practical. I think we've covered a lot tonight, but let's say one could be get the parish priest involved a little bit more in the school, because that bridges the gap than just have relying on teachers. And it makes a whole lot of a difference as a school kid when you have your parish priest involved, playing volleyball with you guys, giving you a talk, giving you some formation and direction. And can you promote vocations? I mean, that could be the first practice.
Especially young priests. And our chaplaincy program is about...
Sorry, we've had Robert. You're back.
I'm back again. I just let you
Hopefully
know.
The devil is not rejoicing.
I've only got 10% left on my phone, so I'm just a little bit worried.
Okay, we're almost through in the end.
We're almost through. But young priests in our chaplaincy program have enormous impact. I can tell you from the feedback I'm getting, they're involved intimately in the playground, in the classroom. They're answering questions of students. They're holding holy hours and adoration for students. They're counseling students one-on-one. They're providing the sacrament of reconciliation one-on-one. They're doing RCIA for students who are not Catholic or not fully sacramentalized Catholics. And I'm reinforcing your point. We have to have more priests involved, younger priests involved. They are great witnesses. They attract young people to consider vocation seriously, etc. And if we can get this program rolled out more and more, all power to it.
Absolutely. And let's now go into two more practical tips. People listening here, let's say they're parents and they're discerning. What's a practical tip that you can give for parents who are discerning, let's say, where do we send our kids during the time we can't be educating them in the faith? They're sincere, that would be the primary educators. What can they do in discerning, let's say, an institution?
Well, first of all, no matter where they send their kids, they have to ensure that they are teaching the faith and modeling the faith in the home.
Yep.
That is 100% absolute, without exception. And then the question is, who do I get to help me in that role? If a parent comes up to me and they say, which schools do you recommend in your system? I can name a couple of schools.
There are a few to be named.
I can name two schools off the top of my head where the religion departments are rock solid, faithful, and doing wonderful things. And there are other schools I can name.
Would it be worth naming them here live on air, or would we
name them? Trinity Auburn, where the Dominican sisters are, Fairfield Patrician Brothers. They have a wonderful RE team there. For example, they're just two examples. Yeah. And there are many other schools with many other individuals doing great work, okay? Look, if parents, as I said, I reinforce their rights. If they think some of these par ed schools are right for them, then that's their call. Exactly. If they're church background and they prefer an Eastern church education and they know that the RE in that school is great and very strongly family based and faithful, so well, good, go for it. God bless them. If they are considering homeschooling and they think that's the way to go, well, God bless them. You know, as long as we all stay humble in our choices and respect each other in our choices. And, you know, if I'm being a homeschooler is a great sacrifice, and it's heroic.
Definitely hard.
And God bless them, you know. And I'm not here to say, you know, I'm on your side or I'm against you or I prefer this or I prefer that.
As long as they come out Catholic.
Yeah, that's right. And
that's our objective, and work for the salvation of their soul. At the end of the day, we're here to work our salvation, and it's up to the parents' discretion. But here are some guidelines here tonight. So what's a third practical tool that, let's say, we can contribute as lay people? Now it's time for the laity to step up. I think if we're going to look at somebody who should be doing something, it is the lay people, the ordinary people in the parish, in the schools, in society. What can they do to make their part and play their part in the 5-year master plan that I like to call?
Well, you know what? If you're a parent, you've got your students in the school, well, you have a right to speak out, and you've got a right to put forward your contribution. You've got a right to bring things to the attention of the principal or the AP or the REC if there's something you're not happy with. And if you're not happy, you bring it to their attention. And if you haven't been served satisfactorily, we have a right to shop elsewhere, okay?
Exactly.
Basically, you're the customer, and the customer is meant to be always right. So insist on the fact that you demand this, or you require this, or you expect this for your children. And if you're not satisfied, we'll go look for and you know, vote with your feet, and you know, etc. Because we don't like to lose enrolments, and we like to say that we're good Catholic schools, and we like to say that we're doing everything right. Well, parents should keep us on our toes to make sure that we're walking the talk. Okay, and also the lay people, get out there and get more involved in the parish, and get out there and support those groups in the parishes that are about adult faith formation. You mentioned Perusia and other groups that are out there in adult faith formation, and start something of your own. Be adventurous, be courageous. You're a lay person, you're doing something of your own. Giving up your own time, you're sacrificing. You're on the radio now, you're reaching thousands of people. And if every lay person lived out their baptism, as St. Catherine of Siena said, if we are the people we're meant to be, that God created us to be, we can set the world on fire where we are.
Exactly. On a practical level, it's time to take action.
Yeah. Don't be passive. Don't be cowardly. Be courageous. Believe in yourself. Trust that God has given you an inspiration, and live it out. Fight it out. Make it happen. Do something. Do anything.
Find your sphere of influence,
yeah.
Whether it be the parish, whether it be the school, whether as a teacher. Yeah. Harness that and take action. Do what you can. Strategize. If people have no problem with finding ways to have a party or do other things, we can do the same for the faith. We have 5 years, let's say critical years, where we are either going to be reduced to numbers, as Cardinal Ratzinger said at the time, or we either improve the situation, we lessen the damage that's coming. I'm not trying to be pessimistic, but we need to take action. It's time for action. The time of empty talk is over.
Give you an example of some positivity here. In the last few years, I've been giving more talks for men's groups and women's groups. They're great avenues of apostolate for parents. Yeah. Earlier this year in February, I spoke at a men's group in Strathfield. And men for the first time are coming to talks. They're going to afterwards inspired to go to reconciliation, to pray again, women's mothers talks, mothers venues, whatever. This is an area of growth. I can see the Holy Spirit working here to give it momentum. And if you do know of a group, men's or women's, fathers or mothers, join it, be part of it.
Exactly. Take action. So it's time for us to make Catholic education Catholic again. Thank you for equipping us with the tools for tonight, this week. Robert Haddad, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation. God bless.
God bless. If you enjoy listening to Catholic Toolbox, why not consider emailing us at thecatholictoolbox@gmail.com to book your next speaking event or consultation. If you like any of our Catholic Toolbox merchandise, you can support us on our online store at spreadshirt.com/thecatholictoolbox, or click the link in the live Facebook feed. Part of all your purchases will go towards supporting the Voice of Charity Radio Network. So be sure to subscribe to and download to the Catholic Toolbox podcast or re-listen to any of our episodes. Soon to come, probably in about 30 minutes, we'll have the podcast up and live on the iTunes, Android, and all other platforms. You can re-listen or re-watch also on the YouTube. Thank you for tuning into the Catholic Toolbox, the art of practical Catholicism. I'm your host and founder, George Manasseh. Until next week, God bless, stay safe, take action. In this era of grave spiritual crisis, it is not enough to simply know about your Catholic faith. That is why we need a Catholic toolbox to equip us with the practical skills necessary to live our Catholic faith to reach our ultimate goal, which is heaven for all eternity. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for the Catholic Toolbox as we hand you the tools to go forth, live the faith, and change our modern world today. Live on the Voice of Charity.